China, which I found really interesting. So I started listening to that and really, really valued your perspective.
Likewise. It seems like we're kind of on the same page here. You know, you don't talk too much about politics in the book.
I'd like to not talk about politics,
right,
if we can.
Yeah, of course. But there is something that you brought up about just like respecting the marginal, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's whatever is marginal is what I'm interested in.
Clearly.
I can't help it. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be, it's so context driven too. And you know, one day one thing's marginal, next day something, you know, it's a sort of monolith and it's something that you have to deconstruct. It's a tricky situation. That's why, you know, getting in these timestamp things, I totally get it, man.
Well, just look at what's happening with psychedelics, right? I mean, it's like moving within the course of 5-10 years from utterly marginal to like totally central, totally corporate, you know.
The middle of the Overton window.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's become a de facto industry for a lot of these sort of tech rationalist types who are capitalizing off of it and using it for, you know, various, I don't want to say like social engineering experiments, but could be. But
I think the hope there is that they're unleashing much more than they actually know, you know, and there's this kind of toothpaste that's going to get squeezed out of the tube that like, they don't really know what it is. And it's going to do things that are hopefully resist that kind of capture, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we can sort of get into it. So how do you pronounce your last name, by the way, Ben?
Oh, Schechter.
Okay. Yeah. So it's Ben Schechter and Matt Baldwin are here with us today to discuss Matt's great collection of zines on how to play guitar. And this isn't just your normal collection of zines. When he sent me this book, it was a complete sort of, I don't know, modern but very unpretentious philosophical system centered around playing the guitar, which is my favorite thing in the world. So it's like you just took the two things that are like the biggest features of my life and you kind of mashed them together. And I was like, man, I wish I wrote this. So if you want to introduce yourself, guys, that would be great.
Sure. Shall I start?
Go for it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, like you, Barrett, I mean, we kind of come out of the same scene in the Bay Area, you know, or variety of scenes that all overlap, or at least that's where I first met you. So I'm a musician, guitar player, and self-taught guitar player, which I think is an important distinction. It's kind of what the book is all about. And I'm also a therapist and I work primarily with psychedelics at this point, work with ketamine. And so, I think what it was for me was I just always had these thoughts kind of banging around in my head. And during the pandemic, I decided to just write them down and kind of get them all codified. I didn't know that I was putting together a system, but it ended up being a kind of system of being a self-taught artist as a means for understanding yourself and exploring the unknown. So that's my background.
Yeah, I'm Ben Schechter. I wear a lot of hats, but mostly I'm a filmmaker and I have a press and I had a bookstore in New York for a long time. I'm from New York or lived there for 20 years and just moved out to LA recently. But yeah, I saw Matt's book, like peak pandemic, just one of the first zines sitting on my friend's coffee table, and I was immediately drawn to it. And I was like, what is this? And I've always loved aphoristic language, just sort of like essays, an essay or book within one sentence. And like that kind of language always spoke to me as like the clearest way to get across an idea, as opposed to like rambling on about something. And so I read it and it really kind of blew my mind, because I'm so used to music writing and music language as being so bitter and angry and left behind and judgy and, you know, whatever word you want to use. But this was the opposite of that. So I reached out to Matt and was like, let's put these out as a book. And we did that, and it's coming out soon. And we're also friends. So it's kind of a sweet story.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's one thing. I say it somewhere in the book because it's like the whole point, like the financial rewards of being involved in any of this stuff are so small or so unpredictable that like the main way that I feel like I've gotten paid is through friendships and relationships. So, and I feel like, you know, they say that men as they get older, you know, this is a cliche, that it's harder for them to make friends. I feel like just being involved in different creative projects, it's not true for me at all. Like I keep meeting people and I keep meeting incredible people. And that's been the great reward of my life, really.
That's a great way to put it. The people that you meet through these projects. And, you know, it's not always good, you know, because when you cast a wide net, unfortunately, and if you're somebody like yourself or me, there can also be like a little bit of exposing yourself to certain energies that are cloaked in things that maybe you don't understand. But because I know like the process of the zines, it started, you know, sometime, I guess, in 2001 and it went to now. Is there anything that you kind of like learned throughout it? Because it ends very, like, kind of differently than it begins.
Interesting. I mean, I think for me, it was like I said before, it was like I kind of realized that I was dealing with a system, and it was about dignifying being self-taught, and recognizing that as a rigorous system, and also as one that gets you results that you can't get through education. You know, and that like I'll collaborate with people who are formally trained in one type of music or another, and it's like they bring me in because my thinking can be stretched out in these ways that you know th there was a fence put around it keeping them from exploring those things. You know, how did you know? I mean, I'm curious, how did you notice the book ending in a way that's different from how it started?
Well, the aphorisms towards the end were increasingly less. I mean, the book isn't necessarily didactic. You know, it's very positive, it's very instructive in a way that really speaks to me because, you know, I'm such an autodidact. You know, I never took a guitar lesson.
To your credit.
I mean, maybe sometimes there's like a bit of imposter syndrome, like, oh, I don't have the credentials to be doing what I'm doing. Do you ever feel you've been hindered by that, or does it just, is this more intuitive thing? Because it's, you frame being an autodidact as something that's like extremely positive. You know, you talk about John McLaughlin, the guitar player, how Miles Davis said, like, just play like you don't know how to play on tribute to Jack Johnson. You talk about Sonny Chirac a lot. These are all guys who I love too. Like these, you know, these are my favorite. Randy Holden, a lot of
Yeah.
Blue Cheer references. I mean, I have a.
Yeah.
That record is sitting on the wall right there.
Yeah, I just actually just picked up my yet another copy of Incipes Eruptum.
Yeah, you talk about how the like idea of recording outside too in the book, you know.
Yeah, their second record, a big part of it was recorded on the end of a pier in New York City. And outside in somewhere in Marin too. Which is an interesting challenge. But wait, so sorry, you were in the middle of saying what were you were saying something about, oh, has it ever hindered me? I mean, I think I got, you know, I went to college in the rhetoric program at UC Berkeley, and I thought I was a real academic. And once I got in there, it was like this kind of whiplash of like, oh shit, I am not an academic at all. In terms of like just realizing that like what they were actually doing there was very institutional, it was very hierarchical, not groovy, not liberated, had real, very strict guardrails on it, you know, and it was more about finding ways to kind of enshrine themselves in different places of power and privilege. And I realized that like all the real radicals or people who wanted to challenge sort of hierarchy left academia a long time ago, you know, probably in the 60s. So I feel like I have that kind of credential, but in getting it, you know, and then I wanted to do a graduate degree in psychology, but in getting it, I realized that wasn't the part of myself that I liked or valued, you know, and it was the things that I learned on my own that had real value. And the things that I learned from going into my kind of own, exploring the edges of things, you know? And so like, you know, I feel like I never felt limited by it. I felt like I actually had to kind of take this long detour into academia to discover that that's not where it was happening for me, and that I had to, you know, it's like that whole thing of like returning to where you started out and seeing it all anew. You know, it's like you know that was my process. with it.
There's like some joke that's like, why are academic politics so harsh? Because the rewards are so small. It's like, I feel like that's kind of counter to your philosophy of autodidacticism or whatever, however you say that. But sort of like the rewards are endless for what you can teach yourself, as opposed to in like this confined academic sense of, publishing and blah, blah, blah. And everything is according to this, what you're allowed to talk about and,
Yes.
what is currently zeitgeisty or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, and I feel like it was just not what I realized is like being amongst academics is that like I realized that like I'm never happier than when I'm hanging out with other artists and musicians. You know, it's like that was those were my people, really, you know. And that there was a much more you know, those people would rate much higher on openness scales than the sort of the standard academic person who I you know, it was the beginning of all that sort of scoldy politics stuff. This is like 2004. You know, it's like right, it was just first sort of starting to be born, you know.
That's really interesting. One of the things that I noticed about the book, the things that I loved about it, was how it was very instructional. There were a lot of kind of like mantras, and it was very aphoristic, but just these kind of like fragments or short form sayings, I thought were, it wasn't like this kind of like post-Victorian run-on sentence thing that we kind of get now with a lot of writers, where it's just like everything, trying to fit in as much as humanly possible. What do you see the zines more as? Are they more instructional, philosophical, meditative? Because you combine so many different things. And what would your advice be for somebody? I guess this is another question, but what would your advice be for somebody who's like reading it, through?
That's a good question. I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, I think it's all of those things, you know, in different proportions. I mean, for me, it was kind of like it was very helpful for me to write all these things down, just practically speaking, you know. Like, I had a guy come up to me recently, and, you know, and say, "Oh yeah, I read your zines. I really liked them. There was this one in there that was just super useful to me." And I was like, "Which one was it?" He's like, it was the zine, or it was the aphorism that said, "Don't let your girlfriend carry your gear in and out of the club unless she's also performing, you know, because she'll end up resenting you." And you know, that comes from my life experience with you know having dated different people, and you know, and he said he was like that was actually very helpful to me, you know, in my relationship, you know, and so like there is you know it is practical. I mean, then again, there's other stuff. There's like little bits of, you know, occultism and, you know, sort of more, maybe more abstract or theoretical philosophy stuff in there. So it's kind of everything all at once. I mean, really, what I was hoping is that it would make people reflect on their own heuristics, you know, their own little rules of thumb that they developed through their own experience. Because I think you know, is kind of their own potential book of these things. You know, like Ben recently said to me, he said, you know, the essence of all self-help is be consistent for a long time, right? That's a great aphorism, right? And it's a great like reduction of this thing down to its essence. And I feel like, you know, all of my friends are interesting people who think around the margins of things. And so I think that ultimately what I would want someone to do is to kind of like use this as a, you know, maybe there's certain parts of it that they annex into their own philosophy, but really to build out their own philosophy, because this is just how I see things and it's what works for me. Certainly, I don't expect it to work for everyone else.
Yeah, one of the sayings that you said in volume 7, besides, writing that you have a celebration of the marginal, is having a fun and productive relationship with the unknown. I think that's something that a lot of artists and musicians and people who are kind of, because we all get swept up in the wanting a kind of certainty or a kind of like set outcome with how we present ourselves. But as we can see now, with artificial intelligence and LLMs, there's a great kind of skewing of what's happening digitally is kind of penetrating everything and it's kind of affecting everything. So I just wanted to kind of like ask you, if you could just talk about the book generally, give some examples, just kind of like go for it, because I think this is a really important book to read. And like I said, like, I don't agree with all of it because I'm not super into the occulty stuff, you know what I mean? But I do think that there's a relationship to openness that people of any kind of sort of belief system need to or wrestle with, like, you know, this sort of time we can't really retreat from it. We actually have to engage with it in a serious and open way and not be afraid of it. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing I wanted with the zines was to create things that didn't really exist online.
Right.
You know, now I have a Substack, I publish there, but I wanted to create things that couldn't be scraped by AI. And like, I don't have some strategy for that. It's just like an instinct that I had. Like, I didn't want that to happen for some reason, you know, because I feel like this, most of this knowledge was, I kind of carved it out before AI existed. And I hope it sort of creates an option for staying human after, once we get sort of like, you know, snowed under with that stuff, you know, I mean, like, that's like kind of a grandiose thing, but I mean, I do think that that's like what I got out of my like local punk scene when I was a teenager, you know, was this kind of this option, like it gave me an option for existing in a way that, you know, was outside the mainstream, you know? So I think that like, you know, I'm hoping that that will continue, you know? And so that's one of the aims of the book. The other aim of the book, I think it sounds corny, like the Joseph Campbell thing of like, you know, follow your bliss, you know, I mean, it's like this is a very, like making music is very important to me, you know, and like, it's like, and at the times when I've been cut off from that, like I've felt very like spiritually unwell. And so I think that like, I'm an experimental guitar player. So, you know, there's not a lot of money in that, you know, or there is sometimes, but almost never. Right. And I think that, so how do you create a framework to keep doing that? You know, how do you keep going? You know, it's like, I mean, I remember you said you quoted Lemmy on one of your episodes where you said best way to stay alive is just don't give up, you know? And so I think that like a lot of these things are like prompts for me to not give up. Mm. Cause I feel like I don't have a choice, you know, like, I mean, like I have to keep doing this thing. That's not, there's no economic logic to it. It's like I lose money pretty consistently. I think the zines were the first thing I actually put out that actually sold, you know, in substantial numbers, you know, and we'll see how the
book
goes.
Isn't that funny? I relate immensely to that.
Yeah. I mean, how do you keep going?
How do I keep going? You know, it's a hard thing because like exactly like you, I'm an experimental musician. Other yeah. than some of the session work and some of the, there was no money in any of it. You know, I think I maybe had two or three good years of like, I can make enough money as being a musician. Like I didn't have to do anything else. You know, that's all I had to do.
What band was that? Who were you playing?
Well, one of them was Son of Ra. And then the other one was The Shrine, which is how do you keep going? And a big part of that, I think, is that when you said that the zines were the first thing you did that actually kind of like, you know, sold really well, it makes me kind of think the same because like when I started podcasting, I was like, oh, wow. There was a period when if you were an experimental musician, it was like, you know, people could just say, oh, you know, like you're in a privileged position. Like you're not giving enough context to why the things you create exist in the world. So in some ways, it's a system that you've created, or even podcasting is for me is like kind of just a way of creating context for the existence or the ideas that I have when I'm, you know, kind of meditating through music. The problem with that is that I'm more of a music guy, and I'm like, I want you to just listen to the music. I don't want you to listen to me talk, you know, and then it, or write or whatever. And one thing kind of takes over the other. So how do you personally navigate that? Because that's something that I've kind of struggled with a bit, to be honest. Not struggled, yeah, yeah. But you know, it's just weird.
You should talk about the book top down level, because where did the book come from?
Oh yes, okay. So I think this is where the book came from it was very clearly it came from, like, there was a moment where the idea for the book, like, someone planted the seed for me. So I was living in San Francisco. I was living in North Beach, and I ordered some books from the OG punk publisher V Vale and Research, and who also played in Blue Cheer, by the way. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, he was an organ player.
Organ player, that's right. So I ordered them from him, and I think he, like, looked at the shipping address, and he was like, "Matt, you live 3 blocks away from me. Why don't you just come over and pick him up, and we can have a cup of tea." So I went over to his house, and I don't know if you've ever been to Vale's place, but, like, you walk into his living room, and it's the headquarters for Research, and so there's all of this archival material, all of these sort of, like, production stations and stuff like that. We sat down and we just started talking, and we were talking mostly about ideas and books, and then he was asking me about my music. And at a certain point, like a couple hours in, he was like, "You know what?" He's like, "You need to write a zine." He said, "'Cause there's all these ideas behind what you do." He's like, "And I don't think your music conveys that in any clear way, like," and he said, and he said basically that, it's almost like the little white square off to the side of a painting that, like a, an abstract painting that sort of gives some context. He's like, "You need to do that." He's like, he said to me, I remember he said very clearly, he's like, "It's how you will develop hardcore fans." And he said it with such certainty too. I was like, I didn't, I wasn't quite convinced, but that's what got me to start writing down the ideas. And I think what he was pointing out is that, like, there's something about, I'm like a Gen X millennial cusper. And so I think that there's culturally this kind of thing that I grew up with, which is that you present your art kind of in a blank, kind of enigmatic way. People are supposed to make of it what they will. There's something a little bit narcissistic about that, right? And like presuming that people will spend the time with that and actually do that. And he was saying that, like, I needed to bring more generosity to it and, like, give people a little context, and like, so that's really, like, that was really the sort of the point of genesis of the zines, and it was to kind of explain what was going on in all my music, because otherwise it's just like guitar music, and I've always had a small, very small group of hardcore fans, but I've never had broad appeal. It's like, it's mostly just created music for my friends, mostly. That's what it feels like, and then a few other, weirdo freaks who like what I do, so yeah, that was where it came from. I mean, I feel like that's kind of what contained us too, right? It's like you're providing context, but also I really like how you play your own music too. I think that's really fucking cool.
The V Vale story is really, that's super interesting. He's like, that's how you develop hardcore fans. Would you
Yeah.
say, but you also have a peer, you that's kind of paradoxical, because there's also like a part of one of your zines where you talk about how to remain obscure, you know? So is there like a tension between those two things? Because I feel that like there's so much in here that's resonated with me.
I feel like the remaining obscure is important for, like, artistic freedom, It's like, I
Right.
mean, like, I feel like it's been a great gift to me. I think as I get better known, if that's even happening, I don't know. Will that, will that limit, like, my ability to express what's really going on for me? Like, I'm not sure, I just know that, like, having not blown up in some band when I was 19, like, at this point, I look back on it and say, "Oh, thank God that didn't happen." I'm really glad that didn't happen. I don't think it would have been good for me, because I like what I do now, and I like who I've become. In kind of growing in the dark, off to the edge.
What's that heuristic? It's like failure is a great teacher for success, but success is a terrible teacher for failure. And so I feel like often if you get that kind of notoriety when you're in your teens or early 20s, like the rest of your life, it's like the high school syndrome where you're like, fuck. But I was thinking like in that white square thing you were talking about, it's sort of like you, like a lot of music that you guys make is, experimental guitar or whatever, but there's this whole discourse around finding how like now like everything's flattened with Spotify and streaming and even more with GPT and all this shit. But It's like this is a signpost to how to find things that's not algorithmic. You know, it's like, and I think heuristically, it's like it shows you that it opens the door, but it's not like pushing you through that door. But you know, you can mention all these people, and you're just assuming someone's heard of Sonny Chirac or whatever, Emmanuel Gacheng, whoever. But like, you know, and in the world now, everything's handed to people, and that sort of removes the specialness of it, you know, in my mind. But if you give someone, you know, a way to figure out how to appreciate that, or you know, it's much better than just giving them an album, like here's some jazz album or whatever. Like that seems important.
Yeah, and I think it's like a little, you know, the book is hopefully a little map of how of something in us that's deeply human that I think it is not AI is going to have a really hard time replicating, you know, because it's like, you know, like what does Friedrich Nietzsche have to do with Chuck Berry? Well, like they meet in me, you know, and I make those two things relate, you know, and like they are. You know, like, I mean, and they do connect in a meaningful way for me. And so I think that's like, it's a kind of anti-algorithmic consciousness that like, it's a kind of like where things slowly accumulate in your character through a series of decisions or preferences, you know, and it's this thing that, I was just in my truck driving here, listening to Garth Brooks, you know, later tonight, I'll be listening to Nino Rota. And I haven't spun this new Blue Cheer record too. Well, what the fuck do any of those things have to do with each other? You know, like I'm the person that says that. And I think that, you know, and I think that you know, the sort of algorithmic consciousness with its kind of constant reversion to the mean, you know, kind of always heading back towards the middle, always, you know, if you listen to some obscure krautrock thing, always suggesting Pink Floyd and Radiohead and Bjork, you know, always. You know, kind of like obviously guiding you back to the most commercial, most known option. You know, it's like this is providing a different option, and it's also an option that can only exist through humans and through human relationships. You know, and like the way I learned about all this music, you know, I learned about you know, Garth Brooks from my sister when I was a little kid. She's like, this is what's good. This is what you listen to. You know, and I learned about Nino Rota. You know, through a friend of mine who turned me on to Fellini's films, you know, and I learned about Blue Cheer from a friend of mine who worked at a record store. Like all this stuff is relational and involves spending time in rooms with people and caring about people.
Right. I think there's like a bit of people sort of shoot down this idea that the personal experience is important in what creates or shapes art. I also think because, you know, if you look throughout history, there's also many artistic movements, when you think of like the literature of Novalis or something like that, who are trying to tap into something that goes beyond, you know, personal experience. And I think people conflate AI and these algorithms with, you know, as having some kind of like absolute property. But I mean, it's just picking up on the binaries that already exist, that are already propagated through the expansion of capital and the consolidation of capital. You know, like there isn't a material and economic aim or telos to all of these, you know, technologies that are very against, like, you know, mentioning having a friend turning you on to Blue Cheer. Like I found out about Blue Cheer because I went to my grandpa's attic and there were four copies of Vincibus Eruptum, you know,
Really?
down there. So that was like how I found out. When I heard Doctor, I was like, this
Yeah.
is the craziest thing I've ever heard. Like this takes all the, you know, thrash metal or whatever, Black Flag or the Germs, and it decimates all of it to me. And this was recorded like 15 years before that. Six, that's crazy, you know? And it's like this, and you also remember exactly where you were when you found something that changed your life. You weren't sitting on a computer, you know, getting getting fed something through Spotify. You're like, I was in that basement. I was at that show. I was with that person. There's value to that. So,
I mean, I remember sitting in a friend of mine's room, and it was a copy of Vincibus Eruptum, and the seams were split, kind of barely holding together, because it seems like every person who ever owned a Blue Cheer record just like utterly thrashed it. Which speaks to a whole way of living that's kind of out of control that I think you ultimately If you want to stay alive, you have to graduate from that. But it's beautiful when you're a teenager. I mean, it's just like so liberating. I remember like the girl I had a crush on at that time. I remember the smell of the room. It's like, so I think that like ultimately how to play guitar is like it's humanist, and it's about something that's very old and like that we're gonna have to return to, I think. I don't think we're gonna transcend into something. I think it's gonna be about returning to something. And I'm really interested in anarchist ideas like agorism, with agorism, you're not looking to have a revolution whereby you seize control and cut a bunch of people's heads off, and all of a sudden, now you run things or keep people from running things. It's more about just keep creating an option for yourself outside and away from, again, on the margins, on the edge. So it's like that's kind of a saying. It's like we don't want control. We don't want control. We want an option, right? And I think that like hopefully this creates something like that, of like a kind of humanist, kind of street level grassroots cultural thing that exists outside of these sort of flattening huge neoliberal, app based, platform, sort of like, terraforming influences on culture.
But isn't agorism like a free market political philosophy? Isn't it like pretty libertarian? I don't know much about it, but that kind
I don't either, to be honest.
of.
I think it's the idea of creating black and gray markets that exist outside of the mainstream market, is my
Right.
understanding
Like
of it.
Shenzhen in China, which I think is a really interesting example that they have. They have a kind of like state nationalized economy, and then they have this whole subaltern
What economic
underground,
zones? Oh,
yeah,
they do. They
economic
know that.
zones that are extremely free and robust in ways that like capitalist
Really?
societies like don't have at all. It's an interesting thing when we sort of talk about, well, what is controlled by, capitalism and the market. I always kind of lean more towards like, Tycoon or workerism or this kind of like Italian autonomist stuff. I've always kind of been interested in that, just because it's like, it's not, imposing a system. It's all about withdrawing from it. It's like, if your job sucks, slack off on your job, take your resources and put them elsewhere. Like it's not this like ham-fisted political hammer and sickle, like I
That's a
This
very
kind of,
Italian philosophy too.
yeah, I like that, the kind of lazy Italian essence of it is something. How do you create these things? Because to me, it's like, even if you write a book, and I'm not criticizing writing a book, I think it's great that you did it, but it's like, how much of it, how do you confuse the machine? Like, how do you disorient it? How do you make sure that the metadata, or do you just be really direct? That's why I like the way it's written, is because it isn't up for interpretation. Like, you say things that are very clear and succinct in the way that you view music and creation and creativity. Is it like, is that the option? Like, what do you guys think?
I want to go back to kind of you were kind of giving the example of the sort of workerism and stuff like that. I think an example of what I'm talking about is the psychedelic underground post Dangerous Drugs Act, which is that like it's a system that was existed invisibly. It was all mouth to ear. It was all knock three times. It was all based on vetting and trust. And it existed totally outside of any medical frameworks. It existed, and it developed its own real distinct culture. And there was a real culture of music sharing, like what good music is to use to facilitate psychedelic experiences. And it thrived, and they did incredible work. Like I don't, I think like, I mean, we don't have to fully go into this, but like I have some real, as a psychedelic practitioner, I have some real concerns about the medicalization of psychedelics and
Right.
like this kind of like be, it being brought onboarded into the kind of the imperial, the sort of the imperial power structure, So, but I think it's a good example of something that existed in a totally grassroots way, in a totally self-sustaining, self-perpetuating way. And they actually developed something that was incredibly rigorous, that when it was time, for, all of the research universities to start understanding what psychedelic healing protocol was, they went to the underground and they just lifted it whole cloth into their system, and they haven't changed it. I mean, there's essentially been no changes to it. So it's an example of something where, they created an option for something to exist that was kind of marginal. It was kind of invisible, and they did good work. I don't think so I think but it was, and it was self-regulating, in this way. And I think there's something really beautiful about that. It came out of the kind of Grateful Dead tradition. It kind of graded into the raver tradition, I think that's kind of what I'm talking about. Like that's the kind of culture that I'm interested in. And I think that stuff is, in a way, pretty private. And I think about, like groups of friends hanging out and how like those are the cultural units that I'm really interested in, Like that's the scale that I'm talking about.
Okay. So you're sort of bringing in psychedelics as a kind of therapeutic practice. One thing that I notice even about your guitar playing is it is very kind of meditative in a way. Would you say that playing guitar is a kind of, do you think it kind of induces this psychedelic mind state? Because I listened to like the first Robin Trower album yesterday. I was like, this.
Which one is that? It's not Bridge of Sighs. Which
No, it's
one?
the one before that with the sphere and it's blue, but I love Bridge of Sighs too, but I'm just like, this just sounds like liquid quaaludes, just the
Yeah.
phase shifter and
Yeah.
the 70s were such a weird time with the stagflation. Like, what role do you think music plays in therapy? Or is music something, because there's also this punk element that you talk about where it's like supposed to shock and offend and like and provoke. Is there like a provocative side? Like, dude, I've never thought about this before, but is there like a place for provocation in therapeutics? Like, I don't know much about it, so
Yeah, I mean, I think there is.
we
I
were
mean,
just talking about that actually with
what
your Repo Man idea.
okay. I had a client that I was talking to recently, and he was asking me, what's the principle that psychedelic therapy works on, right? And I was like, I had just watched Repo Man, and I was like, have you seen Repo Man? And he was like, yeah, I just watched it. And I was like, remember that scene where Harry Dean Stanton is talking to Emilio Estevez, and he says, ah, ordinary fucking people, I hate them. The thing about ordinary people is they move away from confrontation. A repo man moves towards confrontation. And I was like, that's the principle of psychedelic work, is it's moving towards emotion. It's moving towards conflict, inner conflicts, it's moving towards an expanded sense of self. It's kind of the opposite of what like an opiate does in terms of kind of like muffling and numbing and dulling things. So, I mean, like that was like my kind of like simple way of putting it. I think in terms of the role of music and psychedelics, I would say that like, music is this, or sorry, the role of music in healing is that like music is this ocean, and it has this kind of autonomy to it, and that there's this shoreline where it meets healing, and like that's a meaningful place, but it's not the only part of the ocean. I mean, it's actually much bigger than that, So it's like healing is one aspect of music, but I hate it when people reduce it down to that, where they're like, music is just this mathematical tool, and we use it for this reason. It's like what's so great about it is its intoxicating quality that, like what I love about playing guitar is that like I've been playing guitar for 30, 31 or 32 years, and like I still look at the fretboard of the guitar and it's like an utter mystery to me, and like I can go into that and kind of like learn to swim in that water, but it's still an utter mystery how that works, and so it's like, it's not even like a bigger sense of personal identification. It's like losing yourself in this sort of ocean of what can be in that moment. And then also, I get it from listening to other people's music too.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes on music is from Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. He said, "The pleasure we obtain from music comes from counting, but counting unconsciously." I
Well, one more
always
time.
the well, there's a few different ways. He basically says like music is the pleasure the human mind experiences from counting without being aware that it is counting.
Interesting.
you know, which I guess kind of speaks to his interest in the I Ching. And you mentioned one of the I Ching hexagrams in the book, which I thought was pretty cool. It was a hexagram. It was hex 37, I think.
36 or 37, yeah.
Yeah, which one is that again? Sorry.
With like pushing forward with persistence is like
Persistence
is a
amounting to
bad
madness should be avoided or something like that. Yeah.
idea.
Be contradictory to other things you say in the book, which is like, never give up, and the persistence is all, which is like sort of your coda.
Yeah, well, I think it's like that. It just depends on those things are all applicable at different times, right? Like there is a
Right.
time to give up
Totally.
or take a break. Yeah. But I want to talk more about provocation, because I do love, cultural irritants and people who provoke, So like, I think that like music is so many things, and I feel like those are like I love it when it's like that. It's like the quote in the book from Iggy Pop, like I helped blow away the 60s, Like I love that, And like and I like celebrate that. Like that's like there's something about that. It makes room for new things to happen.
Something I'm, you know, interested about provocation is you also kind of mention things in the book just in terms of these kind of like survival strategies, but survival strategies coming from like, I don't know, kind of like an outsider or, you know, provocateur position. You know, like what would you say, like how do you keep that going? Because that's something that I think about a lot.
Yeah. What do you mean? How to keep it going? In what sense?
Like when you kind of talk about provocation, you know, there's a lot of allusions to transgression, you know, like where does transgression fit into all of this stuff? Because again, to me, it's like the most transgressive thing you can do is like fade into obscurity and, you know, survival is in itself kind of avant-garde. So when you quoted that thing from the I Ching and especially on giving up, you know, retreat is also a survival strategy. And it's also something that I think a lot of people in this age of are not really attuned with. They just keep pushing. Like they don't know how to dial things back because when you dial things back, you're looking at numbers and, you know, these numbers are telling you something. They're telling you you're failing economically, you're failing statistically. And people attach a lot of sort of personal value to these metrics. How do you convince people to not take these things too seriously or to find a different way?
The oppositionality idea is, I think, kind of important in that. And there's one of your aphorisms is the best way to deflect unwanted advice is to say, but I don't want to be like you. And I think that's like kind of what you're getting at in with like the idea of oppositionality, finding something to push away from is a way of retreating, but also like a way of living in that obscure place that works for you. And so I think that's a survival strategy.
Yeah, and coming, coming to your own conclusion about how to do that. Like my heroes, growing up from 13 years on, it was really John Fahey and Randy Holden.
Right.
Randy Holden gave up, and returned much later and was never what he used to be. He kind of lost something that he didn't get back.
Man, I saw him at the Whiskey a Go-Go
Really?
do Population 2. It was so good.
Was it?
Oh my God. He didn't
Okay.
look the part, but it was like the vibrato, the everything. It was so I'm just like, again, this is a personal anecdote. He
I
was
believe you. I
awesome.
believe you. I feel like his kind of like Digitech Pro Tools ass sound of his later recordings, I just can't do it, And I think there was something special about that amp, those amps, the Sun Orions. So I have an ongoing search on eBay for Sun Orion amps, and I've watched one and come and go. There's only like maybe 20 something of them in existence. They're so rare that they aren't really even worth anything. But I finally found one, and I flew to Kansas City 2 summers ago to pick it up. It lives at my friend's house in Santa Fe. I haven't gotten to play it yet, but I do own, we bought it together. I own 50% of a Sun Orion, which someday I will make, because that's the record, that's the amp he used to make Population 2 with. So I do have that, which I'm very excited about, because it's like, it's such a mega totem, you know. It's like the ultimate, for me, it's the ultimate amp, you know. It's like where do you go after Blue Cheer? You go to Population 2, and that amp is the sound, that and specially modified Stratocaster.
Right. And is that a solid state amp?
Yes, strangely, you wouldn't think, because he gets such crazy feedback out of it, you know, beautiful silky feedback, but it is a solid state amp. I don't know how that works.
That's crazy.
Wait, I'm sorry, sorry. I want to say one more thing. I want to say one more thing about survival, because I think there's the thing about oppositionality, survival, stuff like that. But I feel like one other thing is, it's like, in my late 20s, I decided I needed a career, because if John Fahey's your hero, you know that he died living in either his car or a series of residential motels, you know. And like, you know, it didn't go well for him. And other solo guitar players, you know, I mean, like, you know, even Stefan Grossman's probably like the most, successful out of them, but he had to do these undignified things, like put out, you know, VHS tape guitar lessons on ragtime technique and stuff like that, which I just, like, something about that was so cringe to me, you know. I respect him and anyone who plays guitar for their whole life and tries to make a living at it. But I decided I needed a career, you know. And so, like, I went into mental health, and like, that has done this one thing for me, which is, you know, it's allowed me to have work that I like, that I'm good at, that's interesting to me, that allows me to then have time and, you know, resources to make music and to continue making music. The kind of devil's bargain there is that I'm just always busy. Like, I'm
Yeah.
extremely busy. So I do both those things, you know, all the time. And now writing too. I have, you know, I'm working on other books. Yeah.
What other books are you working on?
I'm working on a, there's a bunch of essays I've been putting up on Substack behind a paywall. And it's a bunch of essays on, what are they on? They're on, like, perception, aesthetics, creativity. And so I'm thinking it's going to be a book of essays, you know, that I'm going to call a hole in the vortex. And it's going to be, you know, a hole in the vortex, essays on perception, creativity, and psychedelics, or something like that.
That's really interesting. You talk a lot about one of the things. Well, not a lot, but there's a part on memory and attention, and you
Yeah.
say that your memory and attention span are your two greatest assets in autodidact learning. I
Yeah.
100% agree with that.
Yeah, and this is why I'm freaked out about the iPhone. You know, I feel like the iPhone is this, like, vivisecting. It just, like, chops up the attention span. You know, something like Instagram, you know, something like scrolling. So I really try to, I mean, and pretty successfully at this point, to, like, have a very limited relationship with my phone, with social media, just with digital media in general. I was just, you know, talking to someone who was saying he doesn't even own a computer, you know, and I find that aspirational. Like, I wish I could get there. I'm not there yet, and I don't know if I will be, because I like, you know, sometimes I record things digital, sometimes I record things four track, you know. But yeah, I feel like memory and attention span. And so I really do try to have things that I do that improve that. I mean, I think, like, one thing to do is to read, you know. Another thing
Right.
to do is to meditate. Like, those are very practical things to do to kind of
100%.
build your attention span, you know.
I also like how you say if you forgot something, it is likely not important. But I also think you can forget things and they can still be important and you can internalize them even if you can't recall them sort of textually, there's still an importance because you've experienced it in some ways, you know. Some of the old Chinese masters say that if you forget something, it actually makes it more powerful because it means that
Yes.
it's moved through you, you know.
I know, I think about that all the time, where, you know, it's like I've read so much and so much, like, whatever advice or just, like, classical philosophy or ideas, and I'm just like, I can't remember any of that stuff. But then, there's like that Buddhist quote that's like, if you take a boat across a river, like you don't need to keep carrying the boat. And I was like, oh, well, that's like, that makes a lot of sense, because then it's like, it's somewhere in you. And like, I have a 2-year-old kid, and like, in some way, there's like, you don't really remember anything before you're five. And I'm so like, what is all this stuff that we're doing with him before he's five? Does it even matter? And it's like, well, that's like foundational and gets in you somewhere. And I think that's true with every, like, you, no matter how old you are, it's like in there somewhere.
I like also, you talk about imperfection and chaos.
Oh, wait, sorry. I want to go back to the, it was a, yeah, if you forget something. I remember one time I wanted to do a radio show. And this was very, like, when I was younger, I was very inspired by Joe Frank. I had this whole ritual listening to the Joe Frank program on KCRW. Actually, it was coming through KPFA in Berkeley, because I grew up in Northern California. But I wanted to do something similar with radio, like to what he did, which was just so weird and surreal. And I remember I was on the edge of sleep, and I thought of the perfect title for the radio program, and then it slipped away. And the next morning, I was like trying to remember it. And to this day, that haunts me. Because I usually have a good memory, and I'm good at writing things down, and I'm good at holding on to things and capturing things and working with them. And that slipped away, and that haunts me. But it's almost become like kind of a talisman, where like it's this sense of like this charged thing that kind of is hanging in the past or somewhere off in the periphery, that like pulls me towards that feeling of inspiration and helps me recognize it when I do encounter it again. So
Wow.
sometimes forgetting things is maybe useful, in
Right.
some oblique way.
Yeah. Also, imperfection and chaos. You sort of also kind of allude to, having a wild period when you're younger. I was pretty, I had that period. I noticed a lot of people today, especially people who are, highly online and maybe a bit younger, never really went through that. Like they don't really know, like I think Sartre, not to say that, because you have also a thing on morality and you say people who moralize are dangerous. I don't know if I agree with that. I'm a little on the fence about that, but I think people who moralize without dangerous, people who moralize without empathy or without this acknowledging that life is an extreme network of complexities that we are not fully autonomous over, that there are mysteries about to this day. I think that's incredibly dangerous. And I think we're sort of swimming in peak that. And the most transgressive thing you can be is be open to, the fact that life is complex, that there are many things that we can't really. You can't just be like, oh, you talk to that person, therefore you're you know what I mean? I think that's a big problem.
I mean, I guess, I mean, and I don't, I hope I say this well. I guess I'm more, I mean, like, maybe this comes out of my therapist training, I'm not sure. I'm more interested in ethics than morals. Morals seem highly subjective and personal, and oftentimes people use them as bludgeons to, like, to hurt other
I
people.
agree. Right.
I see that. So, like, I mean, but I didn't quite clarify that when I said that. I feel like oftentimes when it's time to go kill someone, it's like people do it on moralistic grounds, because no one ever thinks of themselves as the bad guy,
Right.
But I think ethics are very important to me, like in terms of like how we're going to get civilization to stick together and all get along. But yeah, I think of morals as being more personal, I didn't define my terms there,
Yeah, that's interesting. What would you say though to the people who didn't, have that messy phase? Like what advice could you give to them? Would you be like, go out and get in some shit and then come back and
For sure. I mean, Ben
I
and I just
agree.
had lunch. We were talking about the hero's journey. It's like you have to go out and struggle, and you have to go out and get your ass whipped. And I think that that's good for you. I think that it's like, it's like, hormesis, like that sort of idea of like drinking a little bit of poison to keep yourself, to sort of inoculate yourself against poison. I think that like, I mean, I just sound like a greatest generation. I mean, like, but I was raised by grandparents who, largely by my grandparents who survived the Great Depression and fought in World War II and like did not have easy lives,
Yeah.
and there was this idea that like there was an idea of character and like that was a real thing. I think about like there's been all this drama with my Aunt Helen recently, who's 105, and Aunt Helen s still lives independently. She stopped driving at 100, and she also said, life is good and pretty easy until 100, and after that it's pretty hard, and she had to have like a major surgery. My parents live right down the street from her, and she went to the hospital, took a taxi to the hospital, had it, it's a major thoracic surgery. A couple days later, took a taxi home, took care of herself the entire time. My mom found out about it like 2 months later, and she's like, "Why didn't you tell us? We would have like brought you soup. We'd help you get dressed. We'd do all this stuff." And Helen looked at her and was like, "It's none of your business, it's the last person alive in that from that generation." And so, like a month or two ago, she fell down in the yard, and she laid in the sun for 6 hours, got heat stroke, and they took her to the hospital. And the consensus among all the doctors was she's beginning to die. She's 105. She cooked in the sun. They said that it looked like her organs were starting to shut down. She went into a coma, and so they put her back at her house in a hospice bed, got all the care set up around her, and like 3 days later, my Uncle Tom texts and he's like, "Yeah, she's sitting up and she's eating some banana, And then he was like, "Oh yeah, she got dressed today and she doesn't need her hearing aids." So it's almost something miraculous happened there. And everyone says she's like 15 years younger now, So I mean, I guess what I'm trying to point out here about like struggling, having a period of chaos, the idea is like I think some of that is really good, and I think that like if you're raised during sort of peacetime and times of plenty, more or less, or at least comfort, like that you might have to seek that out, and I always s sought that out, like I'm, again, it's like the repo man thing, moving towards conflict, moving towards disorder, and then and but also not being consumed by it, but I guess what I'm sharing with Aunt Helen is that like character is a real thing and it's actually like measurable, and it's like you can, when someone has it, you can feel it, like she's essentially like almost like a Navy SEAL or something like that,
I know that's like one of my biggest worries about living in California is like the, living in the perma hot tub of Los Angeles and the lack of struggle. I mean, that's much harder now because it's expensive, but I always see all these like swashbuckling boomers moving here and having such like colorful, cool lives. And then their kids are just like kind of like looking out in the distance, like vapid eyed vaping. And I'm just like, God, just like those kids, like that's the lack of struggle or the lack of like a messy period or whatever you want to call it. I mean, I think the idea of having a messy period is like kind of culturally, like it's in every culture. Like the child is like goes out in like, Maasai tradition, they go out and kill a lion before they can come back to the tribe. And like, or I don't know if that's like kind of the idea you're going at, but it seems like every culture has that period, and
Yeah.
I don't think we have that as a
No.
society at all.
I think that's one of the reasons why, America is in this imperial decline. I mean, and I think we've outsourced a lot of our adventurism to machines, technology, surveillance, and,
All that decadence.
Decadence, imperialism, proxy wars, getting poor nations to fight our wars for us. It's just a recipe for disaster. I mean, everything I once kind of believed in America, it's like, this free place, I don't like, you have Walt Whitman, you have like, there was like a,
Emerson, yeah,
yeah,
right.
Emerson. I mean, there was like a kind of, radicalism to the American experiment, and now it just seems completely devoid
Victim
of,
of its own success
yeah, of course,
somewhere.
yeah.
I mean, I want to believe I want to believe that there's still some like homeopathic particle of all that stuff existing in America. And I think it is there. It's like, but it exists in the culture and the cultural expressions, you know? Like, I mean, like, I do feel these incredible surges of patriotism that has nothing to do with like the government or foreign policy or anything,
Of
but just has to
course.
do with like jazz and American music and punk and, you know, everything that happened in San Francisco in the 60s. And Detroit, you know, just all these incredible Memphis, these power centers with, you know, it's like I think that that stuff still exists in the art that comes out of America, but it, you know, it's like, but it's largely being stripped away economically in terms of economic possibility and you know.
I think it also exists in immigrant groups too. Like, you know, it's like in the like white normie world, like sure, there's like the lack of struggle or whatever mess period. But I think if someone comes here, you know, first gen, and their parents are like, you fucking do something, and you can't just like sit and look out the window all day long or whatever, I think that there's a lot of America there too. And like that's not sort of on the, you know, we'll look at that all the time, but you know, you see the Cambodian donut, you know, empire in California and stuff like that. Fucking awesome.
Yeah, you know, I want to sort of maybe like revise what I said about struggle. I do think that people have messy periods, but they're more pathological now. You know, I
Yeah.
think that, like, you know, before when you had a messy period, it was like you getting drunk and doing some stupid shit and getting a bunch of fights. And, you know, like we both lived in Oakland. We were at the punk house. We were at Locos Only, you know, like,
Creamery.
and now I think the messiness has become more insular and honestly sort of more violent in a lot of
And
ways.
more and
Pathologized, like,
yeah, and more mental health has a more feeling of mental health struggle to it,
yeah,
you know, rather than a feeling of adventure.
like there's that joke that's like all the people that are now diagnosed with all these pathologies, and that used to be called a personality or whatever, and it's like that, I don't know.
Yeah, I think adventure. I hopefully the book conveys some feeling of a very personal adventure. I was talking to Ben. He helped me understanding something about myself recently. I said I really like to read Victorian literature, and I don't know why that is, or stuff from around the turn of that century, you know. And I was like, I'm not sure why that is. And Ben was like, it's because it's about adventures. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you read Joseph Conrad. It's like it's always with these sea voyages and all of these sort of like very personal struggles and mysteries and. And external circumstances, storms, and you know, and so yeah, there's something about adventure, you know, from that, you know, those sort of like literary traditions to like, you know, Big Trouble in Little China, you know, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you know, like
Yeah, you
those.
mentioned that in the book, like with you talk about Judas Priest, and you're like, there was a time where people wrote songs about fantasy adventure,
Power and
like power
pleasure.
and pleasure, and like we have to return to that. And I think that that's really missing. I mean, not in rap music or whatever, but like I think that's really missing in a lot of modern culture, is just sort of this uncomplicated sense of I want to have an adventure, I want to have
Yes.
pleasure, or and it, that's that there's so much like postmodern nuance that you have to apply with a million caveats to why you would want that. And that dilutes, you know, people's lives. It sucks.
Yeah. Well, and Barrett, that's one thing I like about you. I like about your show and your thinking. You know, it's like I think like you're this like erudite, you know, person who has all of this like complex ways of thinking about things, but then also there's this kind of like ability to like have just like boneheaded enjoyment of like something, you know, like Southern rock, you know,
Yeah,
like something which I find very relatable, like bringing those two things together. Like I think that's really like if you just have one without the other, it's not so good. But if you can bring those two things together, there's something kind of alchemical about
yeah,
that.
and not just overly intellectualizing it and being like, I like it because of this, but it's
Right.
like those two spheres are different.
I think that's a good way of phrasing it. Is it's like there's just two different modalities, and it's like I think about this a lot. I just had actually Chris Stoffolino came on the show the day before
Oh,
yesterday.
really? I haven't seen Chris for a long time, the piano man.
So we talked about this because he's somebody who is a musician and a critic. You know, he played with the Silver Jews, and it's like
Yeah.
there are ways in which I think, you know, people sort of crouch those two things within each other. And I think that they can exist as a kind of like a holistic thing, but there's also a big part of it where it's like, you know, I just want to watch the NBA. Like, I just want to not think. That's why Baudrillard is one of my favorite thinkers ever. He knows how to shut that shit off. You know what I mean? And just be like, I just want to watch an action movie, you know? And then he would intellectualize it later, but that wasn't the reason he sought the thing out. He sought things out that were stupid because he had some attraction to things that were just dumb and base. And he was like, there's something really interesting about this. There's something we can learn from this. Like, even the American experiment, he was kind of, you know, Derrida had a lot of interest in America too. That's where he got famous. He didn't get famous in sort of continental Europe, but I was always interested in that. It's like, you know, Royal Trucks is my favorite band. It's like they merge stuff like analytic philosophy and all these other things with just butthead Southern jock jam rock and sports football. And it's like, I just love that combo. And I never felt like I could fully go in one or the other. Like there had to be a place and time and then reflect on it later.
It's very human.
And I think it's also like, that's like, you have to have that as an artist, or at least I think that that's kind of a sine qua non for being an artist, which is like you have to have these periods where you're being so fucking stupid that you're essentially unconscious. And then things happen while you're doing that. And then you get to interpret that later or offer it up for interpretation or just kind of suspend it and look at it. You know, like, I mean, I think, you know, like, you know, the idea that the artist just sort of holds things up to be looked at from different angles, you know, it's like, but I think a lot of the time what comes, you know, it kind of reminds me of like Iggy Pop writing lyrics, you know, like Bowie said that Iggy wrote in this way that like he'd never seen anyone write before. And then I remember them asking Iggy and being like, how do you do it? He's like, you know, I get the band going behind me, they're going really good. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. And then he just grabs the mic and he just starts singing, you know? And it's like, he's not thinking this out, you know? He's not using a process. It's like this eruption that comes from the unconscious mind. So like, I think that like being kind of stupid or being kind of spaced out or being able to suspend all of this thinking, this obsessive thinking, it's like, that's where the good stuff comes from.
I 100% agree. I think the only problem with that is to expose your stupidity or ignorance today gets flattened by the internet. Because I think stupidity is kind of synonymous with spectacle, you know? And so people can really latch on to those more exploratory, because I've had them in the show. I've had very kind of messy periods where I was, you know, my nature is to always go to things that people are like, oh, you can't go there. It's like, I'm not endorsing this because I don't know enough about it, but I want to immerse myself in it enough to reflect on it. How do you navigate that? That's something I think is increasingly difficult now. But, you know, you also have all these great sayings about deflecting, about criticism and just not listening to critics and just not listening to people and not letting them have power over you. So what are some sort of ways to get around this? Because especially today, I think it's an important thing for anybody who's interested in adventure.
Yeah, I think there's two things to think about there. On one side of the teeter-totter, it's criticism. On the other side, it's flattery, you know? And like, I talk quite a bit about flattery and compliments in here because I'm susceptible to it, right? Like, someone can blow smoke, you know, for me. And like, and it, like, I can feel that cascade of dopamine, you know, I'm like, it feels good. But like, I can also realize that it's like a kind of simple sugar that breaks down real quick and is not good for me, you know, and doesn't help me make good decisions, you know? And so like, I try to, I mean, those are warnings to myself, you know, like to you know, about flattery, compliments, and advice, you know, other people's opinions, you know, like I'm really not interested in other people's opinions, like really at all. I mean, sometimes they can be useful. I'm also not interested in my own, you know, and this is why sometimes I'll find myself talking about politics and I'm like, I hate this person who's talking to me, you know, because I have all these opinions and like they don't make me feel good. I don't think they're actual solutions.
No.
I think they're, I'm often just spitting out talking points, you know, that I've heard someone else say, and I'm not impressed with myself in those moments. I'm impressed with myself when I'm actually being creative.
Yeah.
Stay off the internet.
Stay off the internet. Yeah, that's another simple one.
I've been really offline lately.
How do you? How does it feel?
How do you do it? Like, would you have any like act like what are your sort of like nuts and bolts strategies to like not be on the internet?
I just treat it as a one-way mirror, you know? I'm off X. I quit posting there because I don't, again, it's like it's a, you know, extremely captured, extremely toxic. Very bad if you want to be a creative person. I've been working on music a lot. You know, I've got an EP coming out really soon. I've got multiple things that I'm just focused on those things. So I treat it as a one-way mirror. And also, if you've done anything publicly, discursively, you're essentially like you're inviting people into your world. And I think that that's bad for creativity. I don't think you should be in conversation in group chats and Discords, and I think those, if you want to create something, those are the last places you should be. You know, you shouldn't be there, and you shouldn't be that available, and you shouldn't be that online. I mean, Carl Jung talks about not being available. You say what you want about him, but I think he has some good points there. Just, and you know, not being available can also mean that you lose financial thing. You know, there's a financial cost to that as well. But long term, in this juncture, I'm talking 2025, it's absolutely necessary for psychic survival, you know? So that's how I feel.
Well, they used to, when they released something into the world, hear every single person's opinion on it. Like that can't be, our brains are not made for that. Like if you just can't contain that amount of information or like vitriol or like just contradictions and just nonsense in general, it sucks.
So I mean, like, yeah, and I think that really it's like, I think we all grew up with these kind of entitled attitudes to success and musical success. You know, you see Jimmy Page with his manor house and his Bentley, you know, and you're like, oh yeah, like on some level, you feel like you're supposed to, you know, have that or something like that. And the reality is that it's like, I think we're kind of again returning to a scale of music where like it's very similar to how it used to be. You know, like I mean, I remember going to England when I was a little kid and seeing these old guys who would just get together and drink beer and sing at the pub together, you know, all these old white-haired people, you know. And it was just like, I feel like my community is very local, you know, here. It's like, I mean, like, and like I'm really interested in what my friends do, you know. I mean, there's some stuff that comes from afar, you know, and there's certain bands that I follow. You know, I'm always interested in what Wu is doing
I love Woo. They're so
yeah, they're the
good.
best.
They are.
Yeah, and so, you know, so there are things from outside of that, but I mean, I think that like again, it's like it's kind of like a localism. Like I've got like my garden here, my permaculture garden of like friendships and relationships. And you know, I used to have these ideas of like someday I'll have all these fans who I have no idea who they are, you know. And you know, I've gotten a little bit of that, but at the same time, really, and now at this point, I'm really much more interested in what my friends think about my music. And I'm much more interested in what they're doing, you know, than anyone else. It's like, and so it's like there's a kind of a big Motley family band feel to it, you know, of you know, and in some way, I feel like it's for me at least returning to this local, you know, smaller scale thing. And thank God, you know, to give up that illusion.
Yeah, I think that like our generation, well, I'm Gen X, but our millennials like watched the death of the music industry like firsthand. Like I watched, you know, being in Brooklyn at 19, I watched people get super successful and it ruined all my friends' brains as musicians and mine too in a lot of ways. It's like, oh, I can do that? Okay, I'm gonna do that. And it's just not reality for most people. And that destroys something in your soul. For a lot of people, I have some theory about specific bands like destroying a generation of men, where like they think that they can achieve X, Y, and Z, and like you just by playing a guitar or whatever, and like you can't. For most people, it's just not possible. So like finding a roadmap to happiness or whatever, if you want to still be a musician, is like kind of what your book's about. And
It's highly personal
yeah, and
too.
that's why it's related so much. But in my own musical journey of like, like also not being taught, not taking guitar lessons, not knowing what the fuck I'm doing. But like Matt's so validating about just like just having the your process of just making music, and like just that's the point, is to make music. And the point isn't the like it's sort of process oriented or something, where it's like you just put album after album after album, or just m make music on it. What you're saying, you're just like working in your room on. And I'm kind of seeing that in film too, where it's like what, Napster and everything did to music, like streaming is doing to film. So like all my filmmaker people are like kind of where musicians were 15 years ago, where they're like, fuck, I have to do this for the love now.
Well,
Or
and I feel like
it's pretty wild.
that's where Wu is again really important, because they were doing this, what, 30, 40 years ago, starting, like where they were doing it for deeply personal reasons. They played almost no live shows, and they just kind of kept going and kept going. I mean, they recorded, I was reading about them recently, they recorded thousands of songs,
Amazing.
just on their own for their own purposes, and when you listen to their music, you feel like you're getting to kind of peer into something that's very private, and I think like I talk about that in the book too, is like there's certain people I'm fans of just for their sheer determination. I mean, Wu has that, and I like what they actually do too, but like
Great
beautiful,
guitar.
beautiful that all the nylon string
Yeah.
through the synthesizer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like I think like the determination, it's like people like Martin Newell, Wu, like these
Vinnie
people.
Riley.
Yeah, they teach us something about determination, and like you do get to watch something happen for them, but it wasn't like some Woodstock moment of like, early, glory. It was this thing that unfolded very slowly over the course of a lifetime.
Right. It's interesting that you say that because I'm a little bit younger. Something that I found coming from that generation of people who, I played in bands, I got to tour, I got to do all this stuff. Just because you were on an album that got like an 8 on Pitchfork, it meant absolutely nothing now. Like there was no revival movement. And now, because now you have these kids and they're part of the trajectory of the show is kind of shedding that, millennial preciousness and getting interested in SoundCloud music, getting into what all of these new forms of cut up techniques and epic collage and SoundCloud rap and all of these sort of and trying to figure out. I genuinely like the music though too, even though like I think it's really interesting and just kind of finding these new modalities of expressing yourself because there's no money on SoundCloud. Like these kids aren't making, doing these mashups. It's like all my friends who are in that world are just kind of doing it. And I met them through the show. And so that's another thing about sort of taking a journey is like you start off in this kind of fogey, indie, experimental guitar. Not, I love it. I love all that stuff too. But then you end up somewhere a little bit different only because you have some kind of curiosity, and it's like I don't know how to make this stuff, like it's not me, but all of a sudden I'm like playing on their mashup, deconstructed kind of sounding stuff, and they're asking me like, oh, can you play a guitar solo on this? And it's like, well, that's something I can actually do and bring to this different, I guess you could say, just a different temp understanding of sound and culture and digital culture and what that means. And so I think that's a part of the messiness too, but it's also like, it's interesting that you get to do that even,
Do you think those kids have different metrics for success in music?
Absolutely. I mean, they're diff they have to be different because the metrics of success that we had don't exist anymore. They're completely different and they're based less on the experience that music brings you in terms of externally and more based on connection, persona, and also the way in which you sort of project all those things outward. You know what I mean? So it's really different that way. Like we weren't
It's almost like
curated.
inside, it's like turning something inside out.
Yeah. Like we weren't used to curating our digital presence, you
Not at
know?
all. I've resisted that.
Like, And interesting enough, the people around our age who were very quick to that, they became really successful, and they had a lot of influence, or at least, and they're still relevant today. You know what I mean? The people who were able to sort of, you know what I
Yeah.
mean? Like,
Those guys are so good at hiding behind like an image, something like I hiding behind an online presence or something. And
right.
I, it's like this sort of like layers of gauze in front of your artistic, like I would love to talk to either of those guys about like, imagine them saying anything as earnest as like there's this some similar sort of level that's like removed from that kind of. I love those guys, but I'm just saying like that they're having a good online presence also necessitates having some sort of like distance, right?
Right.
Like
Yeah.
in your quality of how you make music or something.
I agree. And that distance, I think, is interesting, especially when you are in the world of, as we all are, of also of context, aphorisms, sort of ways of kind of explaining things and explicating things, and also just making things too. Like our trajectory can't be the same, but I think it's also important because you show that there's a way in which you can do both. For a lot of people, the Overton window of thoughts, ideas, concepts, and explaining them, and also like formal practices of making music, were two very foreign worlds that couldn't be interface. And I like what you said in the book. You said you prefer despite instead of because. I like that one a lot. And if you could
Yeah.
explain that, because we're musicians, and despite being musicians and despite being filmmakers, we're having very open, candid conversations that are very exposing and naked and
I think I said this earlier. If I didn't say it, I meant to say it, but I feel like I think the book is to my guitar playing what the podcast is to your guitar playing,
totally.
like where it's like you're being more generous with your ideas behind it, right? And like lo and behold, the world is like, thank you for doing that, like they want that. So like it is exposed. What did you want me to talk more about, sorry, though?
Just the idea of despite instead of
Oh,
because.
despite. Well, yeah, it's this whole idea, despite is that there's this sort of idea of like, your behavior or your personality. The because theory is like, I see this a lot as a therapist, right? It's like, well, because this and this and this happened to me, this sort of causal chain, I ended up being this way, right? And that typically locks you into, it's like a very distinct causal chain leading to one very distinct outcome, right? And there's certain people who live by that theory. You can hear it in the way they speak, right? They're like, oh, because of my trauma, because of my background, because of my education or my lack of education or this or that, right? I've ended up in this place, right? And then there are other people who live by a different principle, and it's a smaller group of people who are live by the despite principle. The despite principle is saying, in spite of my trauma, in spite of my background, in spite of my education or lack of education, in spite of, my social standing or economic status, whatever it is, I am going to be this other thing. And so there's something about the despite principle that's creative, and there's choice there. There's more than one option, right? And so, like, I mean, this is a bit of sort of, I mean, you could call this, some type of, a cognitive therapy perspective. You could also call it a bit of occultism or manifestational thinking, like in terms of like deciding what you're going to make. It's like it's a sort of a more fundamental type of creativity of being like, who do you want to be? I see people do this all the time, right? They might have had a terrible fucking childhood, right? They might have been mistreated in every conceivable way, and still they manage to be a very good parent who has their life together. They are living by the despite principle. And so I think that this stuff, it like really, like there's all this sort of social engineering perspective on how we can create this type of person or nudge people into doing this or that. What I love about this is that it totally it totally resists all of that. And it shows you that sometimes it's just about the individual human will to be like, no, I'm going to be this thing. Maybe everything is pointing me in different directions. I have every reason to be something, to be something else, but I'm actually going to do this thing for myself. So I say that, because is a dangerous word, despite is a magical word.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I think it's like, yeah, how you speak. It comes across in how you speak, you know?
I think that there's something total predeterminist. I believe in like absolute fate, and the
Oh,
only
okay.
sort of autonomy we have are in these kind of like very sort of binary, like ones and zeros ways of assessing, these kind of, I don't know. These structural frameworks for how we operate in the world. That's something that I've evolved into, though. I used to be way more of a vitalist, somebody who believed more in, and I'm not against that either, because I think there's stuff to take from everything.
Course. And what's most interesting is when people make their own their own blends of these things, like, I mean, I that's one thing I like. I like that you're like, I'm a Christian, it's like, I mean, that's like, it's kind of a forbidden thing to say at this point, at least in, I was just saying that, like, I think all of this stuff, like, I'm not interested in an off the rack philosophy or an
Right.
off the rack metaphysical orientation or religion. I'm interested in people who assemble their own systems, So, I mean, I think, being from Northern California when I was raised, like, there's a lot of kind of new thought and stuff in my thinking,
Right.
and that's just kind of, that's the atmosphere it's the water I swam in, but also I was raised Christian, raised Episcopalian, so I still am culturally Christian,
I mean, we both love William Blake.
Yes.
That's a great example of somebody who was combining different things and trying to
You
set. What?
wouldn't want him to be less freaky.
No, definitely not. Like, that's what made him good. It's like,
Yes,
and
that's right.
I think part of the durability of this moment is like, can you live with the fact that people might say you're a little bit freaky? Can you live with the vulnerability of that? Because ultimately, these kind of distinctions that people ascribe, and these, sort of moralizing features of modern degraded social contracts, like, they're going to be outdated pretty soon, I think. And so it's like, eventually, having an ethical system is really important, but also like growing through that and, resisting things when they're, I guess you could say, creativity dismantling forces or anything like that. I think that's.
Where can, I mean, I think book is, it's not available yet.
Yeah.
It's still in pre-order status.
We just got the first like actual
Run.
edition, first run. Yeah, like boxes of them are sitting in my car right now, which is exciting. But we're gonna do a book release in LA, and then a book tour. And Matt's gonna do like
Yeah,
a tour up the
we're
coast.
gonna go up the coast to Portland, and then
Hope do something in New
Might do,
Jersey.
yeah, do New York and maybe Chicago. But yeah, so we're gonna do that. It'll be reading, and it'll be, I'll play some guitar too, some solo guitar.
Awesome.
I'm back on the acoustic. I mean, I'm like, I you know, it's like, kind of like, did this long detour into electric and all this stuff, and
Also, we just recorded an audiobook, which actually is
that's right.
super interesting to do, and just sort of like tactically trying to figure out how to do aphoristic language in an audiobook, and that's sort of like a meditation in its own right. It's
Yes.
like, but it's also like eating candy bars, where it's like, I mean, your book in general is, because it's like, if each sentence is like a novel or like an essay in its own right, then like, how many can you eat in a row? It's like, I think it's important to read your book in pace, like to pace it,
I
like.
was imagining people, like, actually, I was listening to sort of a rough cut of the audiobook stuff, and I was like, imagining people like listening to it to fall asleep, I was like imagining like it might almost have an ASMR purpose for people, so I mean, I I wonder, yeah, I wonder how a book of aphorisms comes off in audiobook form. We figured we would do it just because I don't really know of any other books of aphorisms that are in audiobook format. But and it's also it was a meditative thing, really focused. I was more focused on my breathing than anything else while I was doing it, you know.
I wanted to ask you, Barrett, do you have any favorite aphorisms? Or do you have heuristics that you live by that are like sort of dialed out?
I guess you could say, that's a hard thing to explain, only because I try to, especially now. So to me, it's like most of the things I read aphoristically just come from King James Bible. So I mean, like that's, and obviously the Bible is full of aphorisms. I mean, every single quote, every single thing is an aphorism. Each statement serves a kind of a holistic purpose. And so to me, that's just where I'm at, just
Where what's are there specific quotes from King James version that have been kind of present with you right now, haunting you, think in your mind, thinking about a lot? Which is there one in particular?
do not cast your pearls before swine has been one that's really but that kind of goes back to your thing on obscurity, especially in today's age. It's hard to do that though, because when you are being giving with ideas, you're inevitably going to cast, anytime you transmit anything digitally or through modern communication
Yes.
technology, that's it's so hard to not do that if you're not explicit with your values. And I think ultimately that's where ethics come in, is that we have, at least me, I have to hold myself to a higher account than I used to maybe a few years ago in order to not feel like I'm doing something less good than bad.
Yeah, I think the internet is just casting pearls before swine. Just
Absolutely.
to scale, you know?
Exactly. And there's something about the internet that makes everybody swine
Yeah.
because it brings out the basest level of everyone. We're anonymous and everyone's a hater on the internet.
Well, that's why I think it's good to not be anonymous, to not be a hater, which your book is very much about not being a hater.
Yes.
I wanted to say that actually as a sort of coda was that I think I said it in the beginning, but sort of like my relationship with music writing has been negative, has been judgy, and has been, and I think all that stuff is anti-creative. Like if you read Pitchfork, the last thing you want to do is get your guitar out and play music after that.
Yeah,
It's like
right.
you have a bunch of fucking dudes just like referencing all this shit, and you're being compared against the Pantheon or the canon of all recorded music, and it's like, how can a person deal with that? Like, how can you live in that kind of comparison state, and to remove yourself from that is really important, I think. I mean, for my own process or whatever, but and I think that music criticism and all criticism and stuff like that, especially music, because I don't know, man, there's something, music is so foundational that everyone loves it so much, and that everyone is, and people who have devoted their life to it become very, you can become very bitter, and you can hate someone who's having some success, or even if you like or respect what they're doing. And it in our world, the sort of niche scene, it's like the meme culture is all just sort of hating on everyone, and it sucks. Like it's like I hate that shit, and it makes you not want to be creative, especially because your friends are gonna like say something, oh, I like your album, man, but then like also talking shit or something behind your back. And it's like that this stuff is so endemic. And so, anyways, the reason I'm saying all that is because your book is sort of like a freshwater, a signpost for like how like some sort of more positive relationship with music and friendship and whatever. And that's just like what drew me to it in the first place and what made me want to put it out.
It was another thing that I didn't really know I was doing, until I wrote the book and looked back. I mean, like a lot of this stuff feels pretty alien to me at this point. Like I'm like, where did these ideas come from? Like some of them feel pretty,
Channeled.
it's a snapshot. You're just constantly changing. So it's a snapshot of who I was at one very specific point in time. There's two quotes from the Bible I want to share. One is it's like by their fruits you shall know them. One of my favorites because it's not about what people say, it's about
Say but do.
what they do.
That's so good.
I mean, and so I put that in here, I say by their works you shall know them. I think that that's, I mean, it's one of those things that just separates things and it makes things so crystal clear. Another one is one that I hear it every year when I go to midnight mass with my mom every year on Christmas, and we sing Christmas carols, and they always say, on those who have walked in darkness, a great light has shone. And there's something there about obscurity. There's something there about the marginal. There's something there about a kind of light that I think only shines on the margins, you know, and that you can't get in the center.
That's beautiful. Thanks so much, guys. That was fantastic. I had a really good time. I knew this would be a good one. I just wanted to say, go get this book when it comes out. I think anybody who's interested in creativity, making things, I got a ton out of it. This is my favorite read in a long time. Yeah, I just wanted to thank you guys for coming on. This was great.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
you
And
so much.
yeah, and if people want to find it, I think they would just at this point, what, Google Matt Baldwin, How to Play Guitar.
Yeah.
There's a pre-order. It should be out in like a month. I just wanted to say, like, my favorite thing about this was getting to talk to you again. I've been wanting to talk to you for 15 fucking years. So you know, and I always knew that we would have a good conversation when we did, and that was before I wrote anything or you started this podcast. So it's really cool to connect like this. Presuming it seems like your style, we're both fans of your podcast of
Oh,
this
wow.
podcast. It seems like your style is often to leave this stuff in.
It's weird. I do a lot more editing than people think I
Oh,
do.
really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's
Intuitive. Yeah.
I guess so. I mean, your book's intuitive. That's what I like about it. It's so exoteric. It's practical, but it's rooted in theories and cognitive ideas, and I just got a ton out of it. It was cool that when you reached out to me, because I was like, I remember you from way back in the day as like, oh, that's the really good guitar player who plays like Vinnie Riley and Manuel Gotching.
Likewise, likewise. I mean, I remember you kind of dropped off of my map after you left the Bay Area, and I knew you were playing with Cameron Stallones And I think I saw you play in LA one time when I was down here doing a gig. And then all of a sudden, a friend of mine was like, "Have you heard Barrett's podcast?" And I was like, "No." And it was that kind of thing where I felt like you kind of, stepped outside maybe the kind of the regular binary political discourse and started talking about all these different things that are outside of that.